Good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Gregory Strongs. I'm here today representing the defendant appellant, Mr. Rosales. I will indeed refrain from reviewing the facts except to note two things. One is the really astonishing similarity between the facts in this case and the Grissom case, which is cited several times. Grissom is the 2005 case, providing a kind of comprehensive review of the complicity law in Colorado and its breadth. It's just astonishing how similar they are. I may return to that in a moment, but the other fact that I would like the court to bear in mind initially involves that this case was submitted to the jury on five charges: the first-degree murder, the attempted aggravated robbery, felony murder, and then two lessers, which were the second-degree murder and manslaughter. The defense counsel requested and the court granted the disallowance of the complicity instruction with regards to first-degree murder. It did submit that complicity instruction with regard to attempted aggravated robbery and felony murder. But then it also disallowed that with regards to the two lessers of second-degree murder and manslaughter. And that's particularly important here. I didn't have the record to review today, but my understanding is, and I said in the brief, that defense counsel requested it not be submitted, the complicity instruction on first-degree murder. But I believe it was the court's decision then to not allow it on those lessers. What I want to do is first address the complicity in relation to the mere presence instruction. And I actually want to go down a road that is almost not at all addressed in the brief, and develop that a little bit. It's only touched on tangentially, and that's this decision to not allow the complicity instruction for those two lessers.
That's not an issue raised. How are we supposed to consider
it? It is an issue raised, but only tangentially in relation to the mere presence and how it was the jury was misinstructed.
Where is complicity mentioned in the briefs?
Grissom is referenced there as to how complicity is an appropriate instruction for manslaughter, how you can have complicity despite an unintended death. And again, it's the interplay between the mere presence and the complicity that is at issue in this case. Now, I'm readily telling the court that it is not fleshed out to any significant degree, and my intent is not to surprise or have a trap door here for the Attorney General or the court. And in fact, I would welcome the opportunity to be allowed to do supplemental briefs on this issue.
Why don't you talk about mere presence, which is presented in your briefs?
All right. The mere presence does share this problem with inconsistency. The inconsistency of the complicity instruction, forgetting whether that's error or not. There is this tremendous inconsistency by having two of the charges go with a complicity and two not. First-degree murder we'll forget about for a minute because that was defense requested. So there's, as the Attorney General has pointed out, there can be no error there. That's invited error if it was. But this inconsistency caused the questions from the jurors. And with that problem, there should have been a mere presence instruction here. The jury sends out questions that says, does the defendant need to be the shooter here? Well, they've got problems with where the line is drawn as to culpability. Had there been the complicity instructions, they would have been able to look at both manslaughter and second-degree murder and not ask that question and simply say, well, he doesn't have to be the shooter, so we don't need to send a question out. Instead, they're confused, and The Attorney General, in response to this argument that the confusion evidences the problem with the instructions, the lack of mere presence instruction, says, well, you can't go in and read the jury's mind on this. You can't go in and see what specifically was confusing them or how they resolved it. And I agree. I think that's absolutely right. The problem here is that the questions themselves indicate confusion. That's the only thing we don't have to speculate about. They were confused. If we go in and say, well, there was no prejudice, there was no problem with the instructions, that's reading their mind. That's saying, well, we're going to go into the jury room and say, just by lack of evidence, that they eventually reached the right decision. That's doing exactly what the Attorney General asks or says I should not be doing. But I agree with her and say that the issue here is the confusion that is apparent on its face, axiomatically, by the existence of these questions. So if you've got that, then the court's refusal of the mere presence instruction is not just problematic or difficult, it's flat out error, because this was not a case where the mere presence principle was encompassed in the other instructions.
Doesn't the Chavez case get rid of your argument, counsel? Didn't they address this exact issue in the Chavez case?
My recollection of Chavez was that the instructions taken as a whole encompass this principle.
And they're the same instructions that were given in this case. Is that not correct?
Except in terms of the court electing to strike out the complicity issue, the complicity instruction with regards to second-degree manslaughter.
That wasn't an issue in the Chavez case.
That's exactly my point. Yes.
But nevertheless, the same instructions that the court found sufficient in the Chavez case were given in this case. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. I mean,
why doesn't that obviate your argument?
Well, it's not the content of the instructions that's the problem. Okay, it's the fact that in this case you don't have the full principle encompassed in the other instructions because of the absence of the complicity in these two charges.
That's not what Chavez says, though. It says if you've got these other instructions, that's all you need.
As I pointed out, and the trial court said, well, if I don't have to give it, I'm not going to give it. What Chavez did not say is that this instruction is barred. If you give the proper mens rea instruction,
then why is it plain error for the court not to give it sua sponte?
Because in this case, the court omitted something that wasn't there in Chavez. It created this contradiction in the complicity issue. And this, of all cases, might be one of those rare ones where you simply can't point to the same instructions, the same mens rea instructions that Chavez got and say, it's an identical situation. I would submit that mere presence generally, and I think this is how I have read Chavez, is that generally that principle is indeed contained in the general instructions. But its continuing existence, its very existence, and allowance at certain times would indicate there are circumstances when it is necessary. And this would be one of those. Since I believe that it differs so significantly from the straightforward Chavez, where there is no issue such as the one regarding whether the court erred in not giving complicity for these two lesser charges. And again, this is where I began. Your Honor, with these are really two sides of the exact same coin, and just simply phrased a little differently. Whether by the court changing the complicity instruction, it then became obligated to have the mere presence instruction, or the absence of the mere presence instruction mandated full proper instruction on complicity of all issues. So I don't think this is, you know, on force with the Chavez in terms of the background. It does contain the same mens rea, the general instruction, but I don't believe that that was properly encompassed. And the jury's questions on its face would indicate there was a problem here, that they had a problem here.
Well, the fact that the jury sends out a question doesn't by itself indicate that there was plain error or, in fact, necessarily any error with the instructions, does it?
No.
Is there authority that indicates that otherwise?
No, you're absolutely right. But in this case, the answer that the judge responded with was, yes, he must be the shooter in either of those lessers. That may well have been the error unto itself. If there was no error in the failure to instruct, when that comes back out and he gives them that response, that response on its face would indicate some prejudice. But again, agreeing with the Attorney General, we can't go in and speculate as to exactly what their issues were other than the question presented, nor can we really speculate as to how they resolved it. Again, if the court would consider allowing it because it was just so tangential in the brief I presented, I'd be happy to provide a supplemental brief for that and give the Attorney General an opportunity to look at this a little more closely. I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer L. Ward. My number is 38342, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this action. I have a very sore throat today, so I will try to keep my voice up. If I go too low, please let me know. I'd like to first address the complicity issue that we've been talking about this afternoon. Counsel did not address that issue to the depth that he tries to address it this afternoon. And I would ask the court to please review volume 13 at pages 122 through 125, which is a clarification of the record. What happened here is that defense counsel at trial asked that the complicity instruction not be given. Then later, as spelled out in opposing counsel's brief, he asked for a mere presence instruction, which was denied. Thereafter, in volume 13 at pages 122 through 125, you'll see that defense counsel a second time asked for complicity not to be given. Defense counsel didn't want complicity given at all, and I just think that should be clear in the record. Additionally, as counsel was making his argument, I did check, and I didn't see a citation to Grissom in his brief. Now, I may have missed it because I was looking very quickly, so I'm not familiar with the Grissom that he's referring to. I'd like to discuss for a moment the arguments presented with regard to the theory of the case instruction. Here, defense counsel at trial affirmatively represented to the trial court, I will not be giving a theory of defense instruction. I quoted that in my brief. Now, obviously, if the instruction wasn't tendered, then this is a plain error review. And here, the cases that were cited in opposing counsel's briefs discuss how a trial court has to work with defense counsel in developing the theory of the case when it's been rejected, as it was in Nunez and Parson and Nora. Here, there was no theory of the case instruction tendered to the court. Therefore, to ask the court to sua sponte, draft one for defense counsel, or select one from those that which were given, for instance, the self-defense instruction was given, and that could have been the theory of case instruction. And they take that and draft it. So you're asking the trial court to step into second chair defense counsel, which is an inappropriate role for the trial court to assume. Therefore, there was no error here. No instruction was tendered. Therefore, the trial court had no obligation to change any instruction or draft any instruction. Moving on to the mere presence instruction that was tendered, I respectfully disagree with opposing counsel that the elements of the mere presence instruction are not encompassed in the other instructions given. They are over and over again encompassed in those instructions, instructions 15, 16, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and 24, all address the elements that were in that mere presence instruction that was denied. Because the trial court assessed the instruction package as it stood, looked at defense counsel's mere presence instruction, and found that the other elements were sufficient, the elements were sufficiently covered, there was no error in the denial of that instruction. Moreover, even if this court was to assume an error, it would be a harmless error, because when the jury wrote a question in and said, I'm sorry, it's pages 179 and 180 of volume one, the jury put in a question that about defendant being the actual shooter. When the jury gave that question, they said, does he have to be the actual shooter or just present? They understood that there was more involved than just being present. And although the opposing counsel asserts that those questions suggested confusion among the jury, I assert that those questions asserted discussion among the jurors. And that's what jurors are meant to do. They're meant to go back into the jury room, discuss the facts, and come to a conclusion. And just because there's some internal strife between jurors that possibly is reflected in those questions, it might have been, it might not have been, doesn't mean that they were confused. It means they were discussing the instructions and the facts that they had been given throughout the trial. Moving on, during trial, several photographs were admitted into evidence of the defendant. These photographs were objected to by defense counsel as being unduly prejudicial. The admission of these photographs was in no way an error. The photographs themselves neither showed defendant flashing gang signs or any tattoos that he did have were illegible, except for the one which I identified in my brief, but had no real relevance to a gang. The record shows that these tattoos were simply tattoos. Many people are tattooed. And that in and of itself is not substantially prejudicial in order to outweigh the highly probative value of these photos. And the trial court found the photos to be highly probative. And the prejudice was not substantial. In fact, there was no prejudice in the admission of the photographs. They were just photographs that identified the defendant and photographs that were a visual depiction of his close relationship with Marty Salazar, who was present with defendant in the hotel room at the time of the shooting. These photos were clearly admissible. There was no error in the admission of the photos. Moreover, there was no discussion of gangs in the closing at all. There was no real discussion of gangs. So any kind of gang inference that opposing counsel was arguing there was isn't reflected in the record. Moving on. Prosecutorial misconduct. Opposing counsel asserts that the comments that the prosecutor made in their comment and comments that were unobjected to were inflammatory because he referenced the relationship that the defendant, a man in his 20s, had with a woman in her teens. These comments came from the facts and evidence. These comments were meant to focus the jurors not on the sexual relationship. That wasn't an issue in this case. What was at issue in this case was why the teenage witness recanted her statements, recanted the false alibi she had provided for defendant, and why defendant would have confessed to her. And the reason that they would have confessed is they did have a relationship, whether it be sexual or not, they were in a relationship. And that once this relationship ended, arguably, the witness was no longer under defendant's influence or control. That's why the comments in the prosecutor's closing were meant to focus the jury on why this young woman arguably lied and then changed her testimony. That's simply the purpose for those comments. They were neither inflammatory nor prejudicial. Unless the court has any other questions for me at this time, I would ask you to affirm the conviction of the defendant.
Counsel. Mr. Strauss, you have about 3 minutes, 11 seconds.
Talk quickly. The theory of the defense, the theory of the case instruction from the defense, indeed, they said, we're not going to submit one. This was immediately following the court saying there will be no mere presence instruction. Unfortunately, we seem to never have the benefit of, you know, 2-3 hour discussions in these jury instruction conferences. But I think it's apparent on the record that the mere presence was the theory of the case. And it makes no sense that a defendant's counsel would be required to then follow up immediately and say, but judge, I would like it as a theory of defense instruction. The court has already said that's not going to be there. And just because you recharacterize it, it's not going to be there. And the defense counsel shouldn't have been required to even make that request. So I think the court did have that obligation when it said the mere presence is not coming in. You would be free to recharacterize something there to alter your theory of defense, but that one's not going to happen. Quickly regarding the evidence of the gang photos. The photos themselves are evidence of gang activity, gang association. In the Attorney General's brief, she discusses it as cumulative evidence, cumulative error, and indeed also notes that I'd never characterized it that way in my brief. But this section was inartfully drafted as well because it is not cumulative error that I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is that these photos were improper under 404B, not 403. This is not a probative versus prejudicial way. This is 404B we're talking about. And when the court came to make that decision in the middle of trial, it had already heard the prosecution for several months making incorrect statements, representations to the court about threats to one of the witnesses. I believe it was Ms. Mercado. After the court makes this decision that those photos are coming in fact, Ms. Mercado takes the stand and says, you know what? I once saw a car that looked like one in the defendant's family drive by my street in front of my house, couldn't tell who the driver was, not even sure it was their car. That was the only threat. Well, the prosecution should have known that. If they didn't, they should have. And to have represented the court for a number of months in pretrial hearings that we have the situation where this gang member is threatening her with his family is very problematic. I'm running out of time. I do want to return to the fact that this is 404B. It is not that equal weighing. It is 404B with a prohibition on specific evidence unless there's a demonstration that one of the specific exceptions exists. And that wasn't the case here. And regardless of the prosecution's actions here, the admission of those photographs was error, and I only mentioned the other stuff to put it in context. Thank you. I'd ask you to reverse this conviction and resubmit the matter to the trial.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both of you for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.